Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Ahead on the show today, how big screen versions of popular musicals like My Fair Lady and Sound of Music spelled the end of the so-called roadshow musical. And the oft-consulted neuroscientist and former music producer Daniel Levitin has been called upon for exactly 999 interviews. Today, he'll celebrate his 1,000th with us, and he's bringing a Pick 3 playlist of favorite songs. But first, let's start with some of your nominations in our search for the most romantic song ever. Leading up to Valentine's Day, of course. Now, you can make your case for a romantic song on soundcheck.org, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. That's what Nicole from Brooklyn did.
I still think the most romantic song is Always and Forever by Heatwave. I just don't know what it is about that song. It's just awesome. Thanks so much. Love you guys. Bye.
Wow, suddenly very steamy in this studio. Always and Forever by Heatwave, the most romantic song ever, according to our listener Nicole in Brooklyn. What about you? We want to hear your most romantic song. Make your case at soundcheck.org or leave a message at 866-939-1612. Speaking of romantic songs, the Malaysian singer-songwriter Yuna has written a whole bunch of them over the course of her two American releases. She'll be joining us for a full set and conversation later on in the show, but she's going to start things off for us right now with a live performance of one of her songs. Here is Yuna with Rescue.
She thinks she's all alone, and all her hopes are gone. And so I wrote this song so she can move along. If things were bad, she was in despair. If things were bad, and you were never there. If things were bad, she came up for air. She said a little prayer and she found herself. Yeah, she's got light in her face. She don't need no rescuing, she's okay. Yeah, she's got life in her veins. She don't need no rescuing, she's okay. No SOS needed, no rescuing, she's fine out there. No SOS needed, no rescuing, she's fine out there, yeah. She's got life in her veins, she don't need no rescuing, she's okay. She looks into the sky, and all her tears are dry. She kissed her fears goodbye. She's gonna be alright. If things were bad, they were beyond repair. She was scared, she couldn't handle it. If things were bad, but now she's glad. Can't you tell that she's walking on air? Yeah, she's got light in her face. She don't need no rescuing, she's okay. Yeah, she's got life in her veins. She don't need no rescuing, she's okay. No SOS needed, no rescuing, she's fine out there. No SOS needed, no rescuing, she's fine out there. Yeah, she's got love in her veins.
That's called Rescue, performed here in the Soundcheck studio by Yuna, the Malaysian singer and songwriter now based here in the States and joining us on Soundcheck. We'll speak with Yuna and hear another couple of live performances later on the show.
Three, that's a magic number. Three. It is. It's the magic number.
This week's Pick 3 playlist comes from Daniel Levitin, the author and neuroscientist. Daniel's books include the bestsellers This Is Your Brain on Music and The World in Six Songs. So he's been our go-to guy when we want to talk about music and the brain. And apparently, we're not the only ones, because I got an email from him late last year saying that he was approaching his 1,000th interview and he wanted it to be on Soundcheck. So now, sharing his Pick 3 playlist with us and making his landmark 1,000th media appearance is Daniel Levitin. Hi, Dan.
Hi, John.
1,000 interviews. That's a lot of people interested in music and neuroscience, which was nowhere 20 years ago. What has happened?
Well, a couple of things. One is digital technology now makes it possible for people to create stimuli for experiments that are the same every time you play them, right? In the old days, if you wanted to record something and study it in the laboratory in analog, making perfectly exact copies of it, which is required for a rigorous experiment, that was impossible. So that's part of it. And then the imaging technology. You know, now we can peer inside the brain in real time and watch what's happening there.
And that's how we know that there is no music center in the brain. Like
right.
There is a speech center.
Right.
Instead, music is all over the brain.
Yeah.
Which, was that a big surprise?
It was for me, and I think it was for a lot of people, that music activates virtually every area of the brain that we've so far mapped.
Now, you come at this from a unique perspective because of your history as a musician, as a producer, and then as a neuroscientist. But there are people, I mean, I always had this experience that people would say, well, you know, can't you just, like, listen to it? Why do you have to be picking it apart like that and stuff?
Because that's the fun.
It is the fun,
right,
yeah.
Right.
Of course, I didn't go on to get a PhD in neuroscience, as you did. So for this playlist that you've brought us today, some of these songs will not be familiar to most of our listeners. The first one, though, this song got a bit of radio play back in the 80s by a band called Translator. What do you hear in this song that made you want to bring it to us today?
You suggested that I might bring in a recording that was important to my career.
Mm-hmm.
I was playing in a band in San Francisco that had just broken up, and I heard this on the radio, on public radio, KUSF, and I was so excited. It had all that great youthful optimism and enthusiasm of the early Beatles. It was made by a local San Francisco group, and I just found the melody infectious and the lyrics so fun and clever, and I had to pull over to the side of the road while I was driving.
Ah, a driveway moment, as
yes.
NPR calls it.
Uh-huh. I was so excited by Everywhere That I'm Not that as soon as I got home, I called the record company, and I said, I will do anything I have to do to work for you. I want to be part of this.
So did you work with this band, with Translator?
I didn't work with Translator, but I got hired by 415 Records as initially as a staff arranger and A&R guy.
Wow.
And then became the head of A&R.
Daniel Levitin, the author and neuroscientist and musician and producer with us, sharing his Pick 3 playlist. And starting off with Translator and a song called You're Everywhere That I'm Not.
I thought I saw you. Just someone who looked a lot like I remember you do. 'Cause I thought I heard your voice in a bar making a choice. But no, it was just someone who sounded a lot like I remember you do. 'Cause that's impossible, that's him. That's impossible, that's him. That's impossible, that's him.
don't remember the last time I heard that song. Translator, You're Everywhere That I'm Not. So this is like early to mid-80s,
right? I think it was 81 or so. And the fact that it was local, the record had been made right down the street, you know, and I love the jangly guitars. I love that bass line. And then the two voices. Steve Barton, who wrote and sings the lead on this song, has this clear bell-like McCartney voice. And then on the chorus, You're Everywhere That I'm Not, Robert Darlington comes in with that smoky Lennon-like voice, and they mix so well.
Yeah, so there's definitely a little post-Beatles thing happening with this band called Translator and the song You're Everywhere That I'm Not. Daniel Levitin here with us on Soundcheck, as he has done from time to time, usually to talk about music and the brain, but today, marking his 1,000th interview. So did you find like four or five schmucks to fill in numbers 995, 996, 980, so we could do 1,000 today?
Actually, it worked out just fine.
Okay. So have you always been concerned with how music sounds? Because how we receive music certainly impacts what the brain does with it.
You know, there's different ways of producing records. You can produce a dense record like the Sex Pistols, where you can't really tell what's going on. It's just this massive of monolithic sound.
Right, I would say wall of sound, except that nowadays means Phil Spector and nothing else. But yeah, I know what you mean.
Or you could have more like a Steely Dan or a Fleetwood Mac or a Chicago record where every instrument is arrayed out in space. And I was always attracted to that because as a musician, I like to imagine myself on the stage or in the band and to have the drums over here and the guitars over there in another place. That was very an attractive soundscape for me.
Right. So what does the world of digital music, of MP3 files, of digital compression do to the listening experience?
Well, what we find in our laboratory studies is that, you know, as you know, 90% of the information is taken out, and it fools some of the people some of the time. But it smears a lot of the spatial representation so that you don't get the great definition of where the instruments are.
So will we eventually start missing that? Will the pendulum swing back?
I already am missing it. I try to listen to, you know, WAV files whenever I can.
Right. So you did have a long career before going on to write best-selling books about music and the brain. You had a long career as a musician, as a producer. You mentioned 415 Records, which you eventually were the director of, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
According to Wikipedia, you had the chance to sign MC Hammer, but didn't.
That's right.
What happened?
We got a demo tape, and at the time I got it, you know, it was my job to scout new talent. We were getting hundreds of demo tapes, cassette tapes a week. And it was his demo for You Can't Touch This. And I thought, you know, the public is not naive enough to fall for this same lick a fourth time. It's already been in Super Freak by Rick James.
Yep.
She's a super freak, super freak, she's super freak.
And then it was Don't Turn Around.
Right, the Commissar.
By Falco. And then Laura Branigan had a version of that. And so I thought, you know, four times is too many. No.
So you underestimated the audio naivete of the American public, is what you're saying.
Or I guess another way to put it is I underestimated their desire to hear that great lick again.
You can't touch this. You can't touch this. You can't touch this.
As a musician and a songwriter yourself, what was that experience like? Were you still, was a part of you still kind of like peering over your own shoulder and watching you in that creative process?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. It was very much a reality check to be a songwriter and a musician and then to hear demo tapes and realize how much extraordinary talent there was out there that is never going to be heard for one reason or another.
Well, you wrote this or co-wrote this next song on your Pick 3 playlist. Who or what is Slings and Arrows?
This was one of the demos in the pile of tapes around the time of the MC Hammer demo. I love this band. It was Bart Moore, a Michigan-based singer-songwriter who was living in San Francisco. And I agreed to produce them towards getting them a record deal. Mm-hmm. And I ended up joining the band and playing bass.
For how long?
3 years. And this was just a demo. We never were able to get a deal. For me, it's one of these examples of a great song that should have seen the light of day but didn't, for who knows why.
So the band is called Slings and Arrows, and the song, co-written by Daniel Levitin, is called Irish Green.
I'm going down to see Lady O'Malley. I hope that she'll be wearing Irish green. I hope that you will help restrain me. You know how good she looks in green. Her eyes are sharp and deadly razors. Her hands are computerized machines. When she explodes, she turns the skyline Irish green.
Slings and Arrows is the name of the band, Irish Green, an unreleased track from the archives of my guest, Daniel Levitin, the author of the bestsellers This Is Your Brain on Music and The World in Six Songs, neuroscientist, and sharing a Pick 3 playlist with us on Soundcheck today. His 1,000th interview, which, again, as I mentioned earlier, sort of speaks to the interest, the burgeoning interest in the last 10 years especially, in how music affects our brain. It has been said, Daniel, and I think we've even talked about this in the past, that, you know, the 14 to 16-year-old brain is, like, that's the sweet spot for music. The music that hits you then and hits you hard, that music stays with you for the rest of your life. For some people, it kind of stops after that. You know, they listen to that music over and over again. We recently shared a Pick 3 playlist with Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, who, to his own surprise, found himself, after like 30 years of not paying attention to popular music, coming back to it and finding he really liked some of it. Is that unusual, or does that prove that maybe there is something in the brain that continues to be available to you should you decide to use it?
So Paul came back to contemporary music?
Yeah, he found he loved Arcade Fire, and he gave us a playlist of all like the band Lucius out of Brooklyn. And so but Arcade Fire was his gateway drug. That was the one that made him think, oh, I might still like music 30 years after I thought I had stopped.
Some people, of the thousands of ways that we all differ from one another, one of the most important attributes has to do with openness to new experience. So we all know somebody who, when you go out to eat together, they want to eat at the same restaurant eaten at the last 5 times, and they order the same thing. They might even want to sit in the same table, right? And then there are other people who are always looking for the next big thing, and then there's a whole continuum between that. That's a brain structure, and it's got a neurogenetic basis. Hmm. It's a stable personality trait, more or less, through the lifetime. Some people, then, are closed to new experience. Their brain closes up around the age of 16, and that's it. Other people are open, and they're riding the wave.
So in this playlist that you brought us today, this next song, Tom Brousseau, is this somebody that you discovered kind of later on?
I did. So a year ago, I went to hear the Punch Brothers at the Jorgensen Center at the University of Connecticut. I was very excited to see Chris Thiele, who had just gotten the MacArthur Genius Award.
He's the mandolinist in the Punch Brothers, right?
And I was blown away, as was the entire house, 3,000 people, by the opening act, this guy Tom Brousseau, a North Dakota singer-songwriter. And what touched me right away was the vulnerability in his voice, the sincerity and honesty of what he was doing as a singer-songwriter. And I've always, being from California, I've always been partial to that sort of self-disclosive, vulnerable, you could call it the California singer-songwriter sound, mm-hmm. although people all over the country do it. And I went out and got all his albums, and I just think he's an amazing talent, and I'm curious to see what you think.
I had not heard of him before you suggested that we play this song. And when I heard this, Here Comes the Water Now, I thought, wow, there's definitely something going on there in North Dakota. Tom Brousseau is the singer and songwriter, and this is called Here Comes the Water Now.
There's nothing more that can be done. The battle has been fought, the race has been run. So gals do a curtsy, guys do a bow. Here comes the water. The river wants to take on another form. The river wants to break away from the norm. Basement for a mold, street for a sound. Here comes
Tom Brousseau from North Dakota and a song called Here Comes the Water Now. Part of Daniel Levitin's Pick 3 playlist, the author and neuroscientist with us on Soundcheck. Do you remember your first interview?
I do. It was a New York Times interview about absolute pitch. It was 1999. And I just remember, I don't remember my first radio or TV interview, but I remember, you know, thinking, oh, well, I've seen, you know, great radio personalities like yourself and Leonard Lopate, and you know they just it's you know Bob Edwards, they make it seem so easy. So I didn't prepare, and I learned my lesson.
All right, well, 1,000 interviews later, you've become quite the pro at this, Daniel.
Well, thank you. 10,000 hours of practice, maybe.
Daniel Levitin here to share his Pick 3 playlist with us and mark his 1,000th media appearance. Wanted it to be on Soundcheck, and we are so glad we were able to make it work. Dan, great to see you again.
Great to see you. Thank you.
The most romantic song of all time is Bob Dylan's Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands.
Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands.
Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands from Bob Dylan. That's the most romantic song ever, according to our listener, Robin. Well, we've heard two different opinions already. What about you? What song gets your heart a-fluttering? Just go to soundcheck.org or leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. Up next, the rise and sudden fall of the film musical. And later, more with our musical guest, the Malaysian singer-songwriter Yuna, here in the studio. This is Soundcheck.
That a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down, the medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In a six-month period between 1964 and 65, three movie musicals premiered. Each of the three would sweep across American movie theaters and the Billboard charts. They were Mary Poppins, My Fair Lady, and The Sound of Music. They would collectively get 35 Oscar nominations and would end up winning 18. And they effectively killed the movie musical. So says Matthew Kennedy, author of the new book Roadshow, The Fall of Film Musicals in the 1960s. So fans of musicals, get your torches and pitchforks ready because Matthew is here with me on Soundcheck. Hi.
Hi, John.
So, three blockbuster classic musicals killed the form. How's that thesis working out for you?
Well, so far it seems to be well supported. That's sort of the basis of the book. The idea was that Hollywood was rather depressed prior to these three films in terms of attendance and revenue and so forth. And so the big splash, the success of these three films in such short time created a kind of avalanche of hope, you might say, in virtually all the major studios that said the next big thing are big splashy musicals.
Right.
So they basically put into the pipeline over a dozen, which is actually a lot in a short period of time, and committed a great amount of money and had huge confidence in them. And with a few stellar exceptions, they were either disappointing in terms of profits or disastrous in terms of lack of profits.
Well, now, let me go back to the title of your book, Roadshow, The Fall of Film Musicals in the 1960s. Roadshow is a specific term in the Hollywood industry.
Yes. It was a very, very big deal in the 1960s and earlier. And it refers to a kind of film distribution and exhibiting where patrons would have to buy reserve seats in advance. These films would be shown in downtown theaters, usually only two screenings a day because the films were so long. And if they were musical roadshows, then they would include an overture, an intermission, an entre-act, and exit music.
Mm-hmm.
So you get did I mention a souvenir program? You got a souvenir program.
Wow.
They were
so
higher priced.
It was like going to a show. It was
yes.
like going to a Broadway show, except it was a film.
Yeah. I mean, the idea was very much to replicate the excitement and the sense of event of going to Broadway or live theater.
Mm-hmm. And so this stuff had been happening with some success in the 40s and 50s, and by the early 60s, it's waning.
Yes. So it was beginning to not quite work in terms of, you know, two or three bombs in a row and a studio was devastated.
Yeah. So these three musicals, My Fair Lady, Mary Poppins, and this one, The Sound of Music, for a brief moment resurrected this Hollywood idea of the road show.
He's alive with the sound of music, with songs they have sung for a thousand years. The hills fill my heart with the sound of music. My heart wants to sing every song it hears. My heart wants to beat like the wings of the birds that rise from the lake to the trees. My heart wants to sigh like a chime that flies from a church on a breeze, to laugh like a brook when it trips and falls over stones on its way.
Julie Andrews, of course, in The Sound of Music, one of the big three movie musicals that took over the country, really, both, as you point out, Matthew, both in the movie theaters and the Billboard charts. I mean, the three soundtracks for My Fair Lady, Mary Poppins, Sound of Music were behemoths. They
yes.
were hugely,
I mean,
successful.
Yes, both as films and as recordings. And The Sound of Music was the number one box office film for several years, reached that in 1966.
Now, you write somewhere, I think it's early in the book, about how as an adult you have come to realize that a lot of the things you loved as a kid are actually not very good. What about these three? I mean, you could say the story of Mary Poppins is too thin to support a 2.5-hour film. You could say My Fair Lady is just a bunch of obvious sets, one set piece after another, and Audrey Hepburn doesn't fit the part. You can say that Sound of Music is really sentimental and treacly. Having said all of those things, they're considered classics.
That's true. I mean, I think those criticisms are all valid, and they all somehow speak to mass audiences still to this day. All three of them are part of the sing-along phenomenon today, where people seem to enjoy the sort of camp nostalgia aspects of these films because they stylistically they part so much from what we now take in as movies today.
Yeah, but now here's the nut of your book. You can say that now, that this was the last hurrah, but Hollywood thought, oh, this is the first flowering of a...
Exactly, a great new beginning. Yeah.
So what happened next?
Well, it seems as though Hollywood got a little bit overzealous in the demand for musicals of this sort. So you have simply a glutting of the market in terms of the number of roadshows and, you know, movies that would have required advanced planning in terms of reservations and so forth. I mean, in 1967, there were something like 8 road shows toward the end of the year. And that's a lot of calculating to do when you just want a night's entertainment, you
right.
know, and it's ultimately not live.
And again, you had to reserve tickets in advance at a specific theater at a specific time. It wasn't like, hey, see what's playing down
right.
the road, you know?
Well, yeah.
Now, so among, and much of your book is just regaling us with tales of bloated budgets, bloated actors, you know, behaving badly offset, sometimes on set. One of the musicals that the studios commit to is Goodbye, Mr. Chips. And a recurring theme in your book is people are stuck in these musicals even if they themselves are not very musical.
That is correct. And I don't use this term in the book, but we might call it the Rex Harrison syndrome, which is that if it worked for Rex Harrison and My Fair Lady, then it's going to work for Peter O'Toole and Goodbye, Mr. Chips. So O'Toole gives, actually, I think, a brilliant performance in that film when he's not singing. Mm-hmm. When he is singing, the majesty of his voice is lost. And what remains is a kind of wispy account of sentimentality, which, of course, isn't aided much by the fact that the lyrics are not...
Not the most poetic?
Or penetrating or emotionally resonant.
Let's hear Peter O'Toole in action, so to speak. What a Lot of Flowers from the musical movie Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
What a lot of flowers. What a lot of sunshine. What a lot of beauty in the world today. What a world of color. Just beyond my window, flowers every color of the rainbow. Red roses, orange marigolds, yellow buttercups, green leaves, blue cornflowers, indigo lilacs, and violets, violets. My happy eye perceives.
Peter O'Toole in the film Goodbye, Mr. Chips, singing What a Lot of Flowers. And so how did they do that?
Well, because O'Toole was not a trained singer, there was actually multiple splicing of very brief phrases in this song, and then they were cobbled together in, you know, in post-production. So it appears as though he's singing continuously, but it's actually several dozen, I believe, individual sound bites.
With all the time and money that implies, you
mm-hmm.
know, a staff
yes.
of recording engineers
yes.
and editors and such. Matthew Kennedy is the author of the new book, Roadshow, The Fall of Film Musicals in the 1960s. Out now from the Oxford University Press, and it talks about how Mary Poppins, My Fair Lady, and The Sound of Music were not the start of something big. They were the end of something big for Hollywood. But Hollywood didn't know that. And so under the weight of huge budgets and huge expectations, inevitably, as you point out, artistic decisions give way to commercial decisions.
Yes, yes. And actually, one of the commercial decisions that was made repeatedly, including Goodbye, Mr. Chips, is the idea that a movie star is going to carry a movie musical whether or not they have musical credentials.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than hire, say, the Broadway original or a movie star who also is musically gifted, someone like Peter O'Toole, again, will be able to get by with the Rex Harrison syndrome. Also, Lee Marvin in Paint Your Wagon, Vanessa Redgrave in Camelot.
Clint Eastwood
in Paint Your Wagon. Yes.
All right. Now, this is the second time you've mentioned the Rex Harrison syndrome. Explain that to me.
Well, again, I don't use that term in the book, but it's the idea. I'd say it's the idea that Rex Harrison was so good at talk singing, and it made such an indelible impression in My Fair Lady, that perhaps that technique would simply spill over into other films and become actually a style of its own that could extend beyond Harrison. So
mm-hmm.
you have Richard Harris performs rather similarly in Camelot, and Harrison again sort of mimics himself from My Fair Lady in Dr. Doolittle.
This is Rex Harrison with a song from My Fair Lady called A Hymn to Him.
Yes, why can't a woman be more like a man? Men are so honest, so thoroughly square, eternally noble, historically fair, who when you win will always give your back a pat. Why can't a woman be like that? Why does everyone do what the others do? Can't a woman learn to use her head? Why do they do everything their mothers do? Why don't they grow up, well, like their father instead? Why can't a woman take after a man? Men are so pleasant, so easy to please. Whenever you're with them, you're always at ease. Would you be slighted if I didn't speak for hours?
Of course not.
You'd be livid if I had a drink or two?
Nonsense.
Would you be wounded if I never sent you flowers?
Never.
Well, why can't a woman be like you?
All right, so there's Rex Harrison, Matthew, in My Fair Lady. Mm-hmm. Hugely successful, and he's successful in it with this kind of speech-singing thing. So successful that what happens with Dr. Doolittle?
He sort of slipped into a Henry Higgins mode again from My Fair Lady. I make the claim that it was sort of in his bloodstream by then. I'm not sure he couldn't evoke Henry Higgins, given how long he had played that role.
And certainly the studio wanted Henry Higgins. Mm-hmm. They wanted the success of Henry Higgins, and what they got was this from Dr. Doolittle.
Why do we treat animals like animals? Animals treat us so very well. The devoted way they serve us and protect us when we're nervous. Oh, they really don't deserve us. All we give them is hell. Tell me, how else man repays them? Do we ever think to praise them? No, we don't, and this dismays them, you can tell. We're riddled with ingratitude. We give no love or latitude. In every way, our attitude is, well, like animals.
Like Animals from Dr. Doolittle. Once again, Rex Harrison, not just reprising the method of delivery, but that song is very, very similar to the one we heard from My Fair Lady.
Yes, absolutely.
Look, it's the 60s. Times are tough. The real Camelot, the JFK White House, you know, has ended in tragedy. We're mired in a war in Southeast Asia. And you might look at that and say, well, people need the escapism of a movie musical. And clearly Hollywood was thinking that way. Meanwhile, what's happening out in the real world?
Well, out in the real world, just as you said, John, there's in 1968, there were two huge political assassinations. There was Vietnam. There was the election of Richard Nixon. There were race riots. I mean, the late 60s, as we all know, were a time of great tumult in the United States. And in some respects, the studio's commitment to these musicals makes sense as alternatives to the rough world outside. But the most popular films of the day were actually sort of were veering toward a realism.
Yeah, and as you point out, while they're making Camelot and Dr. Doolittle, the Beatles are releasing Sgt. Pepper.
Right.
So, you know, the generation is changing and somebody's not seeing that.
Right. There's this, you know, with the musicals that had these huge budgets, there seemed to have been almost an avoidance or a denial of contemporary sound.
Mm-hmm. So as we head on into the 70s and things do fall apart, these musicals are seen as kind of hokey, old-fashioned, you know, not really relevant. Although in the 70s, as you point out in the book, I think you use the phrase that Grease was the exception that proved the rule.
Mm-hmm.
So it somehow shows that, you know, nostalgia is still a powerful tool.
Yeah, there was a taste for nostalgia in the 70s, and Grease as a film shows up in 1978 and hugely capitalizes on perhaps boomer nostalgia for the 50s and their childhood.
Yeah.
And Grease becomes one of the great musical hits of all time.
And is it the exception that proves the rule because it is so exceptional, because there were no other movie musicals being made around that time?
There were actually musicals being made. They never really died. What happened with musicals, I'd say, is that they became part of a niche market. So you have smaller budget musicals that are appealing to very specific audiences. And Grease is the one that seems to transcend a limited audience and, you know, has huge return patrons and so forth.
A little bit from the soundtrack to the film Grease.
If you're filled with affection, you're too shy to convey.
Some of the music from Grease from 1978. So movie musicals could still happen. This is like 13 years after the big three, Matthew, that you write about. Mm-hmm. Mary Poppins, My Fair Lady, The Sound of Music. Matthew Kennedy's book is called Roadshow, The Fall of Film Musicals in the 1960s. It's out now. Matthew's with me here on Soundcheck. And I'm sure every parent listening right now is going to be saying, but what about Disney? You know,
right.
Little Mermaid, Aladdin, Lion King, Beauty and the Beast. You know, these were movie musicals.
Yes, and there certainly have been flurries of activity of the musical genre since the 1960s and early 70s. Absolutely, just as Disney, as you mentioned, and also a revival of live action musicals in the wake of Chicago and the success of Chicago.
Mm-hmm. So,
and there are individual film musicals that actually still do very well. Les Mis made buckets of money, so did Mamma Mia and Hairspray as films. But it doesn't feel to me like the genre is fully back with us. It's not like the early 50s and late 40s where there was quite literally on American screens a new musical every week.
Mm-hmm.
And it was coming out from MGM or Fox or whomever.
And it dominated the pop charts, too.
And it dominated
Where all our pop songs came from.
There was a connection, a strong connection between pop songs and film musicals. Now, the theory has been that relationship was somewhat severed or compromised with the advent of rock and roll.
Right.
And it's never quite been reintegrated.
Matthew Kennedy's book is called Roadshow, The Fall of Film Musicals in the 1960s. And Matthew, it's been great fun talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, John. It's been a pleasure.
It don't take a word, not a single word. Go on and kiss the girl. Sing with me now.
We kicked off today's show with a performance by the Malaysian singer-songwriter Yuna. We'll return to hear more of her songs from her latest album, Nocturnal, played here in the Soundcheck studio. That's next. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Singer-songwriter Yuna teamed up with the hit producer Pharrell for this track called Live Your Life on her debut self-titled album back in 2012. The song was a breakthrough for the young Malaysian pop artist, earning her a spot on the Billboard charts and plenty of American fans. Yuna has since released a second album called Nocturnal, and she's here in the Soundcheck studio today to play a couple of songs live for us. Beginning with a tune called Falling, here's Yuna live on Soundcheck.
It's been a long day. Seem to keep up with it. I want to fall asleep so I don't have to remember. Ooh, don't have to call me. I turn my phone off, let the pillows here protect my heart. No, don't have to check up on me, I'll be alright. I turn off the lights and swim into the night. I keep falling, 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 I keep falling for you. I wanna forget. Ooh, all this burden on my back. Ooh, I want to fall asleep so I don't have to remember. Yeah. Ooh, don't have to call me. I turn my phone off, let the pillows here protect. No, don't have to. check up on me, I'll be alright. I turn off the lights and swim into the night. Forget it all, rain will start to fall. Forget it all, rain will start to fall. Forget it all, rain will start to fall. Forget it, you don't have to call me. I turn my phone off, let the pillows here protect my heart. No, don't have to check up on me, I'll be alright. I turn off the lights and swim into the night. I keep falling, I keep falling, I keep falling, I keep falling.
That is Yuna, live on Soundcheck with her song Falling, with Lincoln Jesser accompanying on the guitar. Yuna performing here in the Soundcheck studio today. The album is called Nocturnal, her second release here in the States. It's out now, and Yuna, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, because Valentine's Day is coming up, we're talking a lot this week about romantic songs, and it seems like Nocturnal as an album is full of kind of romance, both in the moment and sort of looking back maybe at a romance that didn't maybe turn out so well. Is that fair to say?
I guess so. I mean, you know, Nocturnal is basically, for this album, I feel like, you know, it's more mature than, you know, the previous songs that I've written. And I guess it's special because, you know, it's very like you said, you know, in the moment. Like I'm 27 this year, you know, so the things that I write about is probably like a lot different than the stuff that I used to write.
When you were, I think I first heard of you when you were doing stuff on MySpace. This would have been like, what, 4 years ago, five years ago?
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
Yeah,
MySpace music?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Back in the days when MySpace was the place. Is that how American producers first heard your music?
That was how, you know, I got a lot of, like, emails coming from America, you know, from music labels, like, looking for me and looking to, like, oh, you know, we wanna sign you and stuff like that. But I never got, you know, back to them. Like, I was a little bit skeptical and like, this is a little bit scary. But that was how, you know, like, I got discovered kind of by my management label. And, you know, I had a music career in Malaysia. I still do. And I was busy with that, you know, like I had a lot of things going on. So it was kind of just like a really scary thing for me to leave everything behind and just like jump into something new. But I did it anyway, so.
I guess I'm wondering what your parents thought of all this and whether, you know, I mean, Malaysia is officially a Muslim country. And I'm wondering how people look upon a young woman going out and being a pop star, you know.
Well, we have a lot of, you know, Malay Muslim musicians in Malaysia. You know, music is something that we love.
There's lots of traditional music.
We love music. We love art. We love culture. And you know, music is one of the. It's a really successful industry in Malaysia. You know, like it's a huge thing. And it was a new thing in Malaysia to have a singer who writes their own stuff. So when that thing kind of just like blew up in Malaysia, for example, you know, I started out. Like 7 years ago, and then there's this, you know, there's a lot of singer-songwriters coming from Malaysia, for example, a really talented singer-songwriter, Ziav, she's also Malaysian, and, you know, she's out here, actually, and she's making music, and you know, her and a bunch of other singer-songwriters. So it was like a new wave that's happening in Malaysia.
And was it in English or were you singing in Malaysian?
I initially wrote a lot of songs in English, but, you know, because of, you know, the Malaysian market, they gravitate more towards Malay music. So I had to, you know, get into writing Malay music, which I love, you know, but it's a little bit difficult for me because I think in English, kind of. So
The albums that you've done here so far have all been in English, but maybe down the road you get to throw in a track or two in
Malay. That would be great. I would love to do that, yeah.
Nocturnal is the name of the current record by Yuna, the Malaysian singer and songwriter who's with us here in our New York studio on Soundcheck today. And Lincoln Jesser accompanying on guitar. This one's called Escape.
I can feel the sunlight on my face. Yeah, oh, I'm so happy. My bags in, I'm not scared, gonna go somewhere. No, I want my Uber from the path that I was on. I'm not gonna stay, I'm gonna try and move along. I'm not gonna change up to the girl I was before. But if I stay in one place, I can't grow. So I'm on my way. I'm flying away. I want to live. I could really use an escape. I could really use an escape. The world is like a book, travel page by page, break away from your cage. See new horizons and live like fools. Learn from your mistakes. I'm just gonna try and touch the sky high up above. No one's gonna stop me from doing what I love. Keeping all the people who are there to cheer me on. And cherish these moments before they're gone. So come on.
Yuna, the Malaysian singer, songwriter, now based here in the States, and a live performance here in our New York studio of her song, Escape. Once again, Lincoln Jesser playing the guitar. Yuna's most recent album is called Nocturnal. It is out now. And hearing Escape in this kind of stripped-down version, it becomes really clear there's some very interesting syncopations in that song. Did you grow up with jazz in the house?
Yeah, I did, kind of. I listened to a lot of Frank Sinatra and, like, Nina Simone and Ella Fitzgerald and, you know,
Okay. Well, you know, those are great role models to have.
Yeah.
But then, yeah. I guess, Western pop and rock, you know. I mean, at Malaysia, for folks who don't know, English is still kind of an unofficial second language, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or well, maybe even an official one.
Yeah, it's actually an official second language. And, well, I grew up, you know, my dad loves music. And, you know, the whole family, we love music. And my dad listens to, like, the Scorpions. And the Beatles, you know, like everything from
Scorpions and the Beatles.
The Beatles and everything. I remember just growing up, driving in the car with my dad, and he puts on, like, Paula Abdul, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
So, like, pop, rock, R&B, everything. So, yeah.
Don't say that I don't have to stay here.
The album Nocturnal is out now. Una, it's been fun having you with us. Thank you so much.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun. Thank you so much for having me.
Tomorrow on the show, the duo from the Takeaways Movie Date podcast joins us with a look at how the Beatles fared on the big screen. Plus a solo performance from Benmont Tench, the keyboardist and co-founder of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. And David Garland of WNYC's Spinning on Air talks about an addictive little musical pattern known as the Andalusian Cadence. You may be surprised how familiar it is. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.